I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with Mia Farrow about Darfur. And later we'll have the latest from Virginia Tech. But first, his breath nervously catching at times, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez went before Congress today to defend the firings of 8 U.S. attorneys last year, acknowledging his mistakes and misstatements as he fought to keep his job. But the top Republican on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, was incredulous that Gonzalez said in a press conference last month that he was not involved in any discussions about the firings, a comment that was contradicted by his top aide and one that Gonzalez has had to retract.
Well, and I'm asking you, do you prepare for your press conferences?
Senator, we do take time to try to prepare for the press conference.
And were you prepared when you said you weren't involved in any deliberations?
Senator, I've already conceded that I misspoke at that press conference. There was nothing intentional. And the truth of the matter is, Senator,
Let's move on. I don't think you're going to win a debate about your preparation, frankly. But let's get to the facts. I'd like you to win this debate, Attorney General Gonzalez. I'd like you to win this debate.
I apologize,
but
Senator,
you're going to have to win it.
Senator Specter said that what Gonzalez once dismissed as an overblown personnel matter has now led to essentially a reconfirmation hearing today for the embattled attorney general, prompting questions about his judgment, credibility, and leadership. Well, joining us on the line from Capitol Hill, Christian Science Monitor congressional correspondent Gail Chadwick. And Gail, the AP is summing it up by saying that Gonzalez says today he played only a small role in the dismissal of 8 federal prosecutors, but skeptical senators reacted with disbelief. We just heard a little of that tone. What's your overall take on the hearings?
I think it's been a very awkward beginning for the Attorney General in what is clearly the most important appearance he has made before the Senate.
What are some of the more startling moments that jumped out at you?
Well, to me what's striking is, again, a question of preparation. He's answering questions that he knew were coming in extremely awkward ways, phrases like, "I now understand there was a conversation between myself and the president."
Well, I want to stop you there because we wrote that down word for word. "I now understand that there was a conversation between myself and the president." What did he mean by that?
Well, he's making a case throughout his responses that he can't get too involved in this even at this point because it's an ongoing investigation. And therefore, he said many times to the senators, "You know more about this than I do because you have had interviews with some of the principals that were involved in it. I can't do that at this point." But what it's left is, on just about every issue that's come up, a sense that the assurances that he gave the American public that there were no improper firings isn't based on much of an understanding of what actually went on. Senator Feingold just raised the point, you know, can you assure us, you know, do you know why these people were fired specifically? And the Attorney General yet hasn't been able to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. So far today, has there been any smoking gun that points to anyone in the administration doing anything illegal? I mean, we just said that he understood that he did speak with the president, but does that lead anywhere?
I haven't heard a smoking gun in that sense, but as Senator Schumer said at the beginning of this hearing, the burden of proof now has shifted. The Senate doesn't need to find a smoking gun. The Attorney General has had so many misstatements about what actually went on that he needs to clarify at this point. That's the key issue. Can he make clear? And what's happening is there isn't clarity. If anything, there's more confusion that is emerging so far based on what he says he doesn't recall.
Cal Sampson was the top aide to Alberto Gonzalez, who testified that Gonzalez did attend meetings where the firings of these prosecutors was discussed. When Senator Schumer asked Gonzalez about Kyle Sampson's contradiction of Gonzalez's own statement, he said, Gonzalez said, "I'm not going to characterize Kyle Sampson's testimony." Leaving what question?
He needs to, because that's precisely the question that the senators need answered. Now, I was very interested in a senator I didn't expect to be a key player here, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama. He is a former U.S. attorney himself and has been typically a very strong supporter of the Justice Department And he began by saying, look, there is clearly politics here. I mean, anyone who watches this hearing senses that Democrats feel they have a real opening here. He says, but there are also serious problems. And he wanted Gonzalez to be very clear on the specific meetings, what he recalls, and to lift the confusion about that's what's gone on for the motives for the firings. And it's his assertiveness that I think has surprised a lot of people watching.
Because you mentioned he was from Alabama. He's a Republican from Alabama.
He's a Republican, and if you lose people like Sessions, it's game over.
Gail Chadwick, congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, reporting on the Alberto Gonzalez hearings today in Washington. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Yesterday, President Bush promised to tighten economic sanctions and impose new ones on Sudan if that nation's president, Omar al-Bashir, does not move quickly to stop the bloodshed in Darfur. Bush says Sudan must allow deployment of a full UN African Union peacekeeping force, stop supporting the Janjaweed militia, and let humanitarian aid reach the people of Darfur.
If President Bashir does not meet his obligations to the United States of America, we'll act.
Well, earlier this week, Sudan said it would accept UN peacekeepers, but Bush's comments follow a UN report accusing Sudan of flying arms into Darfur in violation of Security Council resolutions and aboard Sudanese military planes painted white with the letters UN on the wings. Well, today, Mia Farrow, Goodwill Ambassador for the UN Children's Fund, will speak before the House Committee on Foreign Affairs, asking that body to put pressure on China to stop its support of the Sudanese government. Earlier this week, we spoke with Mia Farrow, who's made several trips to refugee camps in Darfur and eastern Chad, as well as with Liz Walker, a well-known television journalist here in Boston who's done a lot of reporting from Darfur and, after she became a minister, made helping Darfur her ministry. I began our talk by asking Mia Farrow to explain the connection between China and Darfur.
Well, China is pouring billions and billions of dollars into Sudan. Khartoum is using some 80% of those oil revenues to attack the people of Darfur.
You've likened Darfur, in fact, to the mass murders in Rwanda in 1994.
Well, it has been called Rwanda in slow motion. Mm.
And you've written several editorials. In one Wall Street Journal piece, you and your son, who also traveled with you to Darfur, called the upcoming Olympics in China in 2008 the Genocide Olympics. Now, some would say, hasn't China been putting some pressure on Sudan?
Not enough, and only very recently, and only, it seems, in the last couple of weeks. And we don't even know if that's just hollow words. The Olympic Games seem to be China's post-Tiananmen Square calling card to the international community to say, hey, we're A-OK now. Forget our terrible human rights record. Accept us. Enjoy us. Our slogan is one world, one dream. But there is one nightmare that China must not be allowed to sweep under the carpet, and that nightmare is called Darfur.
I want to get to Liz in just a second, but just to staying on this thought, Mia Farrow, you and others also called on director Steven Spielberg, who's an artistic advisor to China for the Games. You called on Spielberg to publicly call on China to use its influence with Sudan to end the violence in Darfur, and warned him that he would go down in history as the Leni Riefenstahl of the Beijing Games. This is a reference to the German filmmaker who made Nazi propaganda films, was jailed for 4 years for her sympathies towards Nazis. I was going to ask you if that was fair, because Spielberg hasn't said he'd make a glorious film, but
it
apparently worked.
First of all, my son and I wrote this article, and we posed the question, does Mr. Spielberg really want to go down in history as the Leni Riefenstahl of the Beijing Games? Do the various television sponsors around the world want to share in that shame? Because they will. Now, while it's true, the Riefenstahl movie Olympia was before the Holocaust. It was well after Mein Kampf was written, and Hitler's terrible ideologies, unspeakable plans, were well known within the community. It may have appear a little sensational, but it's not inaccurate to invoke the name Riefenstahl.
Well, some might wonder if, in fact, you're better off with an inside guy, because some are speculating that Spielberg's letter, prompted by you, to the Chinese president urging him to stop the killings, might have prompted China to send a senior official to Sudan. He called on Sudan to accept the UN peacekeepers, and now we're hearing that they have. Obviously, this is what activists do. Do you feel you might have started this
possible chain reaction.
Look, I don't want to deal in the hypothetical, and we don't know about this peacekeeping force. We don't know. I mean, they talk of a hybrid, or are we talking African Union? There's some talk of 3,000, hugely inadequate to the task at hand. Where are these troops going to come from? I mean, there's a lack of specifics, and promises have been made by the government of Sudan over and over again. We don't know how this will play out.
Well, as we said, you've both been there, and so I want to ask Liz Walker, who's looked at Darfur through her camera lens and been on the ground there. What is the importance of the peacekeepers? Let's start there. I mean, what are you seeing there even now?
Well, right now you have the African Union soldiers there who are under-equipped, who are undermanned, who have not got the backing that they need. And they're peacekeepers, except for the problem is there is no peace. So they can't shoot. They can't arrest. They can't really do anything. So the so they're helpless. Mm-hmm. And you have people being attacked. We hear all the time, including the humanitarian workers who are on the ground. So you have a really bad situation that's getting worse.
Well, in fact, I just heard one of your more recent reports, and I thought, what can we hear that's new about Darfur? And I hadn't heard, and maybe others had. We know how horrendous rape is and that it's used as a weapon of war in Darfur. I didn't realize that the women who were raped, if they were married, are also accused of adultery.
If the woman is unable to prove her, her attack, she can be herself victimized or put in jail. So there's all kinds of awful things. I mean, these are crimes that go on for generations and generations and generations, which is why they use it. It's humiliation, it's shame, it's degradation, and it goes on at last. You only get killed once, but this kind of thing lasts, and it really hits at the heart of a community.
Let's listen to a little of the tape.
Harvard University student activist Jay Williams interviews a young Dinka woman whose story reflects the most common allegations of abuse during enslavement.
We were taken. During the daytime, we were tortured, being beaten. At the night time, even I witnessed about 15 people comes and raped me.
It was during the rape that this baby girl was conceived.
The baby's name is what?
Arej.
And that means?
It means something bad.
Documentary footage Liz Walker and crew filmed in the Darfur region. Liz, again, a television news journalist here in Boston. We've been hearing from her and Mia Farrow, Goodwill Ambassador for the United Nations Children's Fund. In just a minute, how activists are connecting the divestment dots. Do you know where your money's invested? Is it invested in Darfur? They're trying to get state governments and individuals to take their money out of investment companies that fund business projects in Sudan, accused of waging the genocide in Darfur. That's in a minute. Later in the program, we'll speak with the police chief who was in charge in 2005 when the Virginia Tech shooter was scaring so many students and professors. Why wasn't he tracked after he went to the hospital and then came back to school? More after a quick break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
It was a great privilege to go to Darfur. In going there, I became a witness to a genocide. And from that moment on, my moral mandate was clear, and it eclipsed everything else in my life.
That's Mia Farrow late last month addressing the Massachusetts legislature, urging lawmakers to rid the state of its investment in Sudan as part of a campaign called Fidelity Out of Sudan. We have been hearing from Mia Farrow and Boston TV news journalist Liz Walker about the crisis in Darfur. We spoke earlier this week, and I asked Mia to connect those divestment dots for us.
I referred to two giant oil companies that are Chinese oil companies that are pouring the billions of dollars that are going to the attack helicopters and the Antonov bombers and to arm and train the Janjaweed. These companies are being targeted, and companies that are invested in these companies, Fidelity being one of them, Berkshire Hathaway being another, and the moral necessity of divesting from investments in Sudan is now being broadly recognized and growing. Six colleges and universities in Massachusetts alone, as well as I think the city of Newton, if I said that right, have divested. states have already taken a moral stand by divesting, and 18 states are now considering it. So we're really seeing the biggest civic response to an African atrocity since apartheid.
Well, Fidelity's response to your campaign has been to say it believes the resolution of complex social and political issues must be left to the appropriate authorities of the world that have the responsibility, the capability to address important matters of this type. I'm wondering, do you worry that a divestment like sanctions would hurt the poorest of the poor in Darfur?
Not at all, because the sanctions are so targeted. If you go to SudanDivestment.org, you will see they've been so careful to target only that money that would go toward the military. And I found that statement from Fidelity to be particularly outrageous. I was incensed by the thought that they would assume no responsibility for the money. I came to it late. In November, I called my accountant, and I said, where is my pension plan? It's not in Fidelity by any chance, is it? And my accountant called me back, and he said, yes, it is. And, you know, I said, you've got 5 minutes. We've got to get it out.
This whole idea that there are excuses, or we don't have to deal with it, or it's not me, or it's down the street. I mean, there's this arrogance that's a part of that, I believe. You know what? It doesn't matter if it's a penny, if it's a dime. Sometimes you do it because it's the right thing to do.
Liz Walker, you say it's an arrogance, but you've also been vocal about this. You told the Boston Globe back in February of 2005, I think, after one of your early trips to Darfur, you felt there was also a racial element.
Oh, clearly. Well, there you go. I mean, it's Africa, and we're not doing anything. And I, President Bush said, not on my watch when he came in, because he responded to President Clinton and Rwanda. And here we are on his watch. And he talks very strongly on one hand and then does nothing. I think John Prendergast calls it a drive-by diplomacy, where you don't have to put moral will behind what you say. You can say anything because nobody's watching you and nobody's holding you accountable. So, you know, you get fed up.
What would you both like to see? And I want to start with you, Liz. You know, what would you want to see? Troops?
I think if we just put robust and stick-to-itiveness in our diplomacy. Is it because every time we pay attention to these guys and we send people over, the United States, and we really stand behind our word? And if there, you know, if you don't do this, we're going to do that. If we stick to what we say, action could be taken. But I think what we do is just say one thing and then head on off to another part of the world. So that would be one part. And of course, if it takes military action, then so be it.
I would like to see, while we're dreaming, a standing force at the United Nations. When there is a determination of genocide made, then a force should have to go in.
Absolutely.
I just want to jump in. U.S. Ambassador Negroponte was in Darfur. He's saying, you know, that the government of Sudan must disarm the Janjaweed. But he also said something I want to ask you about, Liz, because it affects your work. He says that the Sudan is doing an active, deliberate campaign of intimidation of international aid workers, denying visas, harassing aid workers.
You sense that. Of course they're afraid. These are supposed to be neutral people who are just trying to save lives and not be involved in the political end of anything. So if they're attacked, that's the last stand before you. It's all total chaos. And it is a frightening situation and it has to be stopped.
Mia Farrow, we understand the first phase of this agreement with Sudan, that UN troops will come in. And as you said, many are questioning whether this will actually happen. But the first phase of a light support package, including some police advisors from the UN, civilian staff, some resources, has been sent to Darfur. We'll wait with you to see how that unfolds. But in the meantime, I understand that you wear a talisman around your neck. Is it a gree-gree? How do you pronounce it?
Yes, that's right. A gree-gree. It was given to me by a woman named Halima, whom I met at Zamzam Internally Displaced Persons Camp. She had five of them around her neck, and she insisted on taking one off and giving it to me. And she described the day her village was attacked. She had been holding her baby son, and Janjaweed came from two sides, attacking the village, burning the huts, and she held onto her child. And she felt compelled to tell me how she had done her best to hold on to her child, as if somehow she hadn't held on tight enough. If she had held better, maybe it would have had a different outcome. Maybe her child wouldn't have been torn from her arms and bayoneted in front of her eyes as he was. Three of her five children, she said, were similarly killed that day. Janjaweed, she said, they cut them and threw them into the well. And then she clasped my hands and said, tell people what is happening here. Tell them we will all be slaughtered. Tell them we need help. I'm trying to tell people.
Mia Farrell, Goodwill Ambassador for the United Nations Children's Fund. We also spoke with Boston Television News journalist Liz Walker, two women who have made it their mission to spread the story about Darfur. For more about their work and an upcoming event in light of their work, go to our website, here-now.org. Quick note, tomorrow on Here and Now, NPR's woman in Rome, Sylvia Pagioli, on all the news in that region. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. That disturbing video footage of Cho Song-hui sent to NBC News along with an 1,800-word diatribe written by the Virginia Tech gunman have given the public a closer look at the troubled 23-year-old, but police say no further clues on why he'd murder 32 people. Meanwhile, university officials today announced all of the victims would receive posthumous degrees, and students will be given the option of ending their semester now instead of finishing the rest of their classes. Well, Lisa Anderson is New York bureau chief for the Chicago Tribune. She's in Blacksburg, Virginia. And Lisa, what is happening on campus, given kids were told they could leave?
Well, Robin, actually, we're seeing sort of a steady stream of people leaving. The campus is much more empty today, as is the town, than it was yesterday. So clearly a lot of students have chosen to go home. And whether or not they choose to take the option that's being offered now by the school to leave and let their work to date determine their final grade, we'll probably know more on Monday.
Well, as we mentioned, Cho sent those chilling videos, photographs to NBC. We're not going to run the sound now. It doesn't seem as if it would add anything to the discussion, but he said to people, you had 100 billion chances and ways to have avoided today. Now you have blood on your hands. What are people there saying about NBC's decision to air that footage?
Well, I haven't spoken to a lot of students this morning about that specifically, but it seems that there is a real mixed feeling in the community about whether or not it was appropriate. Some people clearly, especially families who have been affected, clearly found it very troubling. Journalists are being asked, I know I've been getting emails this morning about whether it was appropriate even for us at the Chicago Tribune to run the photo, that very distinctive photo of Cho with outstretched arms and a gun in each hand in our newspaper today. So I think there's a divide between those who are just totally offended and think it's insensitive and those who really don't mind so much because they're hungry to find out why this guy did what he did.
Right, and as police said, we don't really get any clues from that, except it, you know, they haven't said this, but it would seem to show his illness. The university is also being grilled on its response to Cho. We learned today that on December 13th, 2005, a court magistrate, ordered Cho to undergo an evaluation at a psychiatric hospital. Doctors there ended up approving him for outpatient treatment, saying he posed a threat to himself but not others. In fact, the court papers show that the doctor checked a box that said Cho prevents an imminent danger to himself as a result of mental illness, but he did not check the box that it would indicate a danger to others. Here is Dr. Christopher Flynn, director of the Virginia Tech Counseling Center, responding to questions about whether the university knew about Cho's diagnosis.
You're addressing the issue of what happens to clients when they're released from hospitals. I am sure every person who is released has an appointment in hand for follow-up services when they're released from any medical facility. To my knowledge, we were not individually notified, but I'm not sure I can say much more than that at this point.
Lisa, is anything more known about what follow-up Cho was asked to do? And are people at the school talking about legal issues?
Well, first of all, I think that there's a great question out there, which is, did the school do enough? Is the school remiss in that it didn't follow up on Cho? The campus police, they were the body that referred him on that December day to a state public health agency, which then got the commitment from the Virginia magistrate to have him put into a public facility for treatment. And as I understood it, he was deemed at that time an imminent danger to himself and others. The problem seems to be that had the school made the referral itself, it would have been notified and it would have provided the follow-up. They have apparently a staff of psychiatrists and psychologists here to do that. But because the referral was made by the police to a public facility, apparently under the law, the school was not necessarily or not informed that Cho was hospitalized and what the outcome was and was not included in his post-release treatment. So it's a little bit dicey as to exactly where the responsibility lie, although there are people who certainly feel that the police should have done some follow-up or made sure that the administration was fully aware. The police chief here, Wendell Flinchin, said this morning that they did tell the administrator on duty of what they had done in taking him for referral and his hospitalization, but that after that they no longer had a responsibility in this matter.
Lisa Anderson, New York Bureau Chief for the Chicago Tribune, will be speaking to the former police chief, the one who was chief when Cho was at the school, in a few minutes. Lisa, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you, Robin.
There are so many questions. How could someone who was ordered by a court magistrate to be evaluated and then evaluated by a doctor as being someone who could pose imminent danger to himself then buy guns 2 years later? Joining us now is Daniel Weiss, senior attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. And Daniel, the mental health question has become an important part of all of this. As we know, Cho was approached by campus police. We heard what happened in a courtroom. Why would this not have shown up in a background check for a gun purchase? What does show up in a background check?
Under federal law and under Virginia law, background checks are fairly weak. They look to see if you have a felony record. You check the box whether you're mentally ill or not, and if you check no, then the only check against that is if records have been submitted to, in Virginia, the state police, or in many states, only to the federal government.
Well, there was some time that he did take between gun purchases, and he abided by the gun laws there, the gun law that you had to wait, what, 30 days between purchases?
Right, but each purchase itself took only a matter of minutes. The background check was done very quickly.
We have been talking about the guns that Cho Song-hui used as opposed to assault weapons, but could anything Cho did have been prevented by the assault weapon ban, which just elapsed?
He actually purchased a large-capacity magazine, which was illegal under the assault weapons ban.
What does that mean, a large-capacity magazine?
It's a magazine that can hold more than 10 rounds, and that's important because that means you don't have to reload as often. That's why police are so concerned with high-capacity magazines that they were banned by the assault weapons ban. But President Bush, unfortunately, allowed that law to expire 3 years ago.
This is Daniel Weiss, senior attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, obviously a partisan on this issue for more gun control. But Daniel, I have to ask you about what we're hearing from some listeners, and also it's very much the chatter online, that in fact, if there hadn't been a ban on students carrying weapons on the Virginia Tech campus, a ban that was passed in the Virginia legislature last year for all campuses and was supported by Virginia Tech officials, the students who were under assault this week would have been able to fire back. There are people who are saying that, in fact, a gun ban left those kids helpless.
That's really incredible to say that we need to send our kids to school armed with a loaded gun, ready to shoot a fellow student who they think may be threatening them.
And do you think that any law would stop someone as troubled as Cho Song-hui seems to be? Do you think that Cho would have gotten a gun no matter what law?
Well, it's very hard to say whether a particular person could have gotten a gun. The question we need to ask is, have we made it as hard as possible for dangerous people to get guns? Those are the questions we as a nation really need to ask.
Daniel Weiss, senior attorney at the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Here and Now. Well, Until yesterday, a former University of Maryland College Park police officer told us that his school and others have threat assessment teams that track students who show potentially violent behavior. Well, earlier today, we spoke with Deborah Duncan. She was police chief of Virginia Tech until July of last year. Now, she had no access to files, but she was chief when there were complaints about Cho. So we asked her, first of all, do you remember him?
No, I don't remember him specifically. No, I don't.
Do you remember any of the claims against him, the stalking, that he, for instance, was so disturbing Professor Nikki Giovanni that she asked for guards at her class?
I don't remember specifically his name, but that would not be unusual for us to get that kind of information. And what we would do would have officers talk with the professor and talk with the people involved and follow up on it. We took everything like that very seriously.
Well, now, it's interesting. I do want to move on, but you said that wouldn't be unusual. Really? There are that many cases that you had to handle of professors made uneasy by students?
Well, you know, it's all relative on what you're talking about, how many. There were several. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it just wouldn't be something that you know, would be that unusual.
Well, we know security varies from school to school, but there's a growing trend toward threat assessment teams. Yesterday, we spoke with a retired policeman from the University of Maryland College Park. His school has a threat assessment team and also a beta team made up of social workers, for instance, that helps evaluate student behavior. Did your school have either a threat assessment team for the campus police or some other kind of team?
We did have a crisis intervention team, and that was made up of the officers and working in relationship and in conjunction with mental health agencies in the county. So there was such a team.
Well, help us understand them, because the biggest question, or one of the biggest questions, seems to be if Cho Song-hui was approached by campus police because of claims of sexual harassment, if he was asked to seek mental help and then a court ordered him to be evaluated, why wasn't that followed? I mean, is that a part of the assessment team to then follow, you know, what has happened to a student as they re-enter the school?
What we did at the time was the best thing to do at the time. It was referred. He was referred. There was no criminal charges at that time. Nobody wanted to press any criminal charges, but there weren't any. And I do know that he was referred for assistance, and then at that point he did seek assistance.
It sounds like you're telling me that there was no way of tracking his reentry to the school after he went to the hospital.
Well, as far as the police department's concerned, that wouldn't have been something the police department would have tracked.
Yeah.
Now, I can't really speak to, you know, as far as the other agencies or the other departments on campus.
Right. And some would say, why not? Is that something perhaps that should be happening?
Well, you know, hindsight's 20/20. Mm-hmm. Everybody has an opinion. You know, you can speculate. That would be a good idea, but, you know, it's just hard to say at this point.
Well, I guess one of the reasons I asked is, you know, were there legal concerns, or was it just not something that had come up, this idea of, you know, following students who had been so on the radar?
Yeah, I really don't have the answer, answer to all that. I'm not going to second guess.
Do you think this is something that should be implemented? You know, some sort of tracking system. We're understanding that, you know, there's software. And as I said, the software helped another school stop an attack.
Well, you know, technology are advancing every day. There's just new things that's coming up every day, certainly. You know, if we can come up with technology that could help track, then certainly we'd be interested. We'd be all for it. Anything that we could do to help make our community safer would be something that would be worth considering.
He was eventually sent by a court. A court order did order him to go to a hospital to be evaluated because the court determined that he was a risk. Is there any cross-pollination between the courts and the police? In other words, some people would assume that that kind of a court order would go right to a campus police and it would be filed somewhere. You're telling us that that doesn't necessarily happen.
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. I'm not aware of what would happen. So that's a question I can't answer right there.
Yeah. Well, Chief Duncan was police chief of Virginia Tech until July of last year, is now police chief in Monroe, North Carolina. Thanks so much for speaking with us on this very difficult week.
Thanks, Robin.
And, of course, we'll continue to follow this story. Well, earlier I apparently said the music of Sly Stallone. That would have been interesting, but not as good as the music of Sly Stone and the Family Stone. After a quick break, we'll hear more of that here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Hey, Sly! Let's do it like we used to do it!
When Sly Stone made his appearance at the Grammy Awards in 2006, younger viewers might have wondered what all the fuss was about. The mohawk hair seemed out of place, the artist out of it. But this is the organist whose hits I Want to Take You Higher and Dance to the Music anchored rock radio for over 30 years. Now Sony's legacy label has remastered the 7 albums Sly and his family Stone built their reputation on in the late 60s and early 70s. That Sly and the Family Stone making their breakthrough appearance in the Woodstock movie with their hit, I Want to Take You Higher. Our music critic Tim Riley says these recordings tower over everyone, from George Clinton to the Black Eyed Peas, and he joins us with his usual no-holds-barred take on this time, Sly and the Family Stone. Tim, welcome.
Hi, Robin.
Well, he did look very different when he came out at the Grammys last year.
Well, yeah, you know, he's an older man now. That blonde mohawk and those sci-fis. He was always well-known for his sunglasses, you know, but he did look kind of wary and out of place, as though he'd sort of strayed from his handlers and hadn't taken his medication. Mm-hmm. But this was only the latest chapter in a long, tragic fall. Someone once said that Rod Stewart was the biggest waste of talent in rock. But a recluse like Sly Stone would really give him a run for his money. But, of course, that wouldn't be true unless Sly Stone's early work, made during some of the most heated racial strife of the late 60s, was some of rock's most joyous and affirmative music.
Right. People miss him. Let's hear a little more of it. What are we going to listen to?
This is actually the very first single from the first album from 1967, which is called A Whole New Thing, and the single is called Underdog.
Hey, Dick! I know how it feels to be expected to get a fair shake, but they won't let you forget that you're the underdog and you got to be twice as good. Yeah, yeah. Even if you never write, they get uptight when you got to write, or you might start thinking too much. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know how it feels when you know the real, but every other time, yeah, you get a raw deal.
So, Tim, set the scene more for us. 67, Summer of Love. Take it from there.
Right. Well, it's 67. It's a summer of love. British psychedelia is all the rage, and most black hits are coming out of the Memphis Stax label or the Motown Pop Factory. You remember, in this era, even Jimi Hendrix, who turned out to be rock's only black superstar, he had to go to England to get a recording contract. So the idea that Sly Stone appears with, you know, really what you might call, you know, roots funk or R&B. I mean, it's a real genuine blend of rock impulses and R&B soul sources that he puts into this kind of a soul rock fusion with an integrated band, so that both black and white members of the band, actually a white drummer playing some very sophisticated funk rhythms, and also mixed gender. So he has, you know, one of his cousins, Cynthia Robinson, is a trumpet player, and a really good trumpet player.
This all comes out of San Francisco.
And it all comes out, so it's the only place it could come out of in some ways. The first record doesn't really do too well, but the second record is called Dance to the Music, and of course that spun off several top 10 hits. And then they turned in their legendary Woodstock set in 69. So that by the time their greatest hits album came out in 1971, it was an instant number one and an instant classic. And as that record was topping the charts, he was at work on his dark social critique, a very dark record called There's a Riot Going On, which portrayed the black family's dysfunction as part myth, part travesty.
One child grows up to be somebody that just loves to learn, and another child grows up to be somebody you just love to burn. Mom loves the both of them, you see it's in the blood. Both kids are good and mom, blood's thick thicker than the mud. It's a family affair.
That's Family Affair from There's a Riot Going On. I've been doing some reading, and some people say, you know, Sly's music in the 60s was all about optimism and breaking down the walls, and 70s was disillusionment. What do you hear when you listen to these hits 35 years later?
Well, it is interesting. Hearing it 35 years later, of course, I can't describe what it was like to hear these hits firsthand. But when you listen to them with 35 years of history under your belt, you get a very interesting appreciation for his early triumph as a fusion of civil rights optimism and then all of the stuff that starts erupting. Remember, Martin Luther King was assassinated and Robert Kennedy Jr. Was assassinated. So the very idea of a multiracial rock band making communal music in the wake of these events held out a certain utopianism that was as charged and as meaningful as anything else that rock produced in that era. But by 1971, this optimism was fading, and when Sly toured behind There's a Riot Going On, his dilemma was palpable. How could he keep making joyous, liberating music in the midst of the ongoing riots, the FBI black power crackdowns, and rock's own segregated seating arrangements? Mm-hmm. The music was still extraordinary, but it was laced with defeat. Like, listen on this song, You Caught Me Smiling Again.
You caught me smiling.
So, Tim Riley, what, after all, is Sly Stone's legacy?
Well, it's a very mixed legacy. On the one hand, you have this irrepressible music that reeks of dance, soul, rock, and funk, and carves out spaces for Funkadelic, Prince, Arrested Development, Public Enemy, and on and on and on. I've always thought that rappers didn't pay enough attention to Sly's influence. Mm. On the other hand, you have this burden of a ginormous talent who succumbed to addiction and failed to sustain his career beyond those first 6 years. So what these remasters make clear is just how promising Sly Stone's vision once was. It's a catalog that flies in the face of every cliche about the 60s because it's all here, and it's all very complicated. The hope and the despair, the harmony and the dissonance. And on his last great effort from 1973, an album called Fresh, it's a funk masterpiece that updates James Brown. It wasn't that he reached too high or hoped for too much. It's more like Sly Stone's hopes were too ambitious for the world his audience made him live in.
And you have made us think. Tim Riley talking about the new release of the remastered 7 albums from Sly and the Family Stone on Sony's Legacy label. Tim, what shall we exit on?
This is a song from Fresh called Let Me Have It All.
Tim, thanks.
Thank you, Robin.
And for more information on the new Sly and the Family Stone releases or to read Tim Riley's blog, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio Internet.